Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
By the way, did you notice the suit's tie today?
Rather festive, yeah.
I mean, that's something like you get as a gag gift.
I have some Christmas ties at home, and I called an audible last night and decided not to wear a tie for tonight.
Those are one like, oh, this will be funny. Everybody get a kick out of it. And then, of course, you never wear it.
Only thing it doesn't do is light up.
And then somebody goes out and they go, hey, this is great. Yeah, we'll be talking about this one all night. All right, we'll get to Kerry Miller in a few moments. First of all, our play-by-play call today, Patrick Hornquist, a big night, and Mike Lang on the call.
Dumoulin paid the price as he played it up the left side. Malkin racing for that biscuit. It comes back free, still in the zone. Picked up by the Penguins. Hornquist, he shoots and scores. There's a goal again by Hornquist. That's three. A natural hat trick. And the mad Swede has given the Penguins a 6-3 lead. 72. What a night.
Mike Lang with a call on the Penguins Radio Network. I don't think we can refer to anybody on our staff as the Mad Swede. They'd probably be called in by the FCC.
Oh, my God. You just wait for those Mike Langisms to pop up. But the cool thing is, that was a moment where he just let that moment breathe, which is really cool. He just picks those spots where...
Yeah. Absolutely. No, Mike is a Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's bring in Kerry Miller, college football writer for Bleacher Report, joining us for the first time. Kerry, welcome. Great to have you with us on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Okay. An obvious starting point is going to be Urban. It is no surprise to anybody. So what was your viewpoint of all of this as to how it played out?
Really, my viewpoint of the whole Urban thing was a lot of really talented writers were not able to write good stories about football because so many people had to talk about this for 4.5 months. If he would have just retired in August or September, whenever that news broke in the first place, I think this season would have been a lot more enjoyable for most of us. But we all kind of eventually figured it was going here, whether he retired now or at the end of next season, after the way things ended for him in Florida a few years ago. Whether we were being serious or facetious, you always saw people talking about, eventually he's going to say it's for health reasons and he'll be gone. And now he is. And who knows if he'll be back again in a couple of years. I know he said he's, as far as he's concerned, he's retiring, but he is only 54. We'll see what happens.
You talked about how it hung over the entire season. You know, as someone who has to cover this all the time, is there a certain point where you feel... just internally, you know what, I better at least jump on board and write about something about this because it's expected.
Fortunately, I didn't have to because we had Matt Hayes was able to handle all of our Urban Meyer columns. I think he ended up writing like four of them throughout the season. I'm sure he's beyond fed up with it. it really does. It's kind of like I also cover college basketball. It's like the FBI thing where it's just like, you don't want to talk about it, but it's there. You know you have to. It's just kind of like you said, he said it felt like it just hung over the whole season, and it feels like that for us in the national media as well.
Yeah, and in terms of doing play-by-play, which I do for football and basketball at Penn State, Penn State's going to play Ohio State. The topic is going to come up. All right, fine. You want to talk about the game. And then same thing with college basketball. I mean, last year I did a tournament. Oklahoma State's there. Lamont Evans isn't there. So you feel like you have to, you want to talk about the game. I know I'm a simple sort, but that's what you want to talk about because that's the fun part.
Yep, I'm the same way. I just want to, let's let that be off-season stuff. When the games are actually happening, let's talk about the games. That's the fun part. But, it was weird, watching Ohio State games throughout the season. I mean, I think during that overtime game against Maryland, I was watching, and they must have talked about Urban's headaches and his cyst and his health problems for like 30% of the game. I was like, this is an incredible game. Let's just talk about football.
Right, exactly. Well, then I'm watching Ohio State, Michigan. They're going on about, you know, and of course the stress of having to change the system and install him as quarterback. He picked him. He recruited him. He picked him. He wanted to just keep playing the same style and play Tate Martell.
Exactly.
All right, let's get to the games itself. When you look at the Alabama-Georgia game, what's stuck out to you about that, Kerry? And in reality, should we have a greater appreciation about how fine the line now is between Alabama and at least a couple of teams?
I'll start with the second point. I mean, I do think that game kind of told us that Alabama isn't perfect. I mean, they should have lost that game. And it really felt like heading into the SEC championship, I mean, they were favored by 2 touchdowns against a team that, if that game hadn't been played, would have been in the college football playoff. I mean, that's kind of crazy. Like, if you'd had Clemson in that game against Georgia, it would have been more of a coin flip proposition. I think that states how far ahead of everyone we thought Alabama was, and that's probably no longer the case, especially now that, you know, Tua's ankle is a little bit up in the air. But for me, the two big things that stuck out about that game were the two special teams plays. The one that everybody's talking about, the stupid fake punt heard around the world.
Yes.
That was, I have no idea why they did that. I mean, if they had that planned in the playbook at any point, like there was a 4th and 2 from the 47, 2 possessions before that, like that would have been perfect for that. I don't know
sure.
why you'd want to pull that out on 4th and 11. But
right.
The other one was Rodrigo Blankenship missing that field goal that would have put Georgia up by 17. I mean, I was watching that game, and it just felt like one of those turning moments that they blew their opportunity, and, you know, you let that juggernaut stay alive. If you don't cut off Michael Myers' head, he's going to come back, right?
Right,
They let Alabama come back in with that 30-yard chip shot miss by one of the best field goal kickers of the last few years.
College football brings with it a series of inequities that then plays out in the college football playoff. One of them is there's not been a single season yet where a team that played in a conference with 8 conference games has missed. 9 conference games, there have been teams that have been missing left and right over time. There have also been teams that haven't played in their conference championship game or camp. Notre Dame is this year's example. How do you view the inequities, and do you think they should be corrected, or do the inequities make it more intriguing?
I think it should be more balanced, since we are forced to compare teams like Oklahoma and Georgia. You know, 8 conference games versus 9 conference games. Those were the two that were really going head to head in the end. And, you know, Georgia got to play games against like Middle Tennessee and I think Alabama A&M and all this stuff. And Oklahoma actually scheduled aggressively. I think that did kind of work in their favor in the end. But I do wish it was. I don't care if it's 8 or 9 games, but I wish all 5 of the power conferences played the same slate. Now, I think we're always going to have Notre Dame out there, or Army, or, you know, maybe BYU becomes relevant again. There's still going to be that independent factor, but as far as the major conferences are concerned, it should be the same amount of conference games. Obviously, there's not the same amount of balance from top to bottom. I think the SEC and the Big Ten are ahead of some of the other leagues in that regard. So they're, by making them play 9 games, it may at that point feel like they're being penalized. But I don't understand the point in the ACC and the SEC being allowed to play these 8-game schedules.
Yeah, I don't care if it's 8 or 9. It should be equal across the board. Or maybe say, hey, look, you need to play 10 Power 5 teams. I don't care how they work it out. Which then brings me to the Alabama Mercer, Alabama Citadel part of it. I know it's Alabama. I got it. Okay, so I start with that. But there are only 6 times the entire year where the College Football Playoff Committee ranks you. One of those 6, they play the Citadel. All right, you know, or last year they played Mercer. In fact, Mercer was their last win before they played Clemson. Should something be done about that? Some sort of, you know, the College Football Playoff Committee to me is the one that has to lay out what the mandate is. What about that issue?
Yeah, I think that is a good point. It's ridiculous that the SEC every year gets that, you know, the Week 12 buys, basically. I mean, it wasn't just Alabama. It was the whole conference. I think the only teams that played legitimate games, it was like Missouri played Tennessee or something. That was it. Everybody else was playing a joke.
Yeah.
But
right.
Yeah, and the ACC has kind of dipped its toe into that well as well, because they have that extra week where they don't have to play a conference game. So I think by balancing the schedules across the leagues, that would help eliminate that. But Alabama really is the master of working the schedule in their favor. They always get the bye week before LSU. They always play that FCS opponent before the Iron Bowl. Like, they every year I'm trying to come up with preseason, looking at the top 25 teams, what's their trap game? And every year I look at Alabama, I'm like, there's not a trap game on the schedule.
That's right.
They painted it perfectly. You're already the best team in the country. Why do you need that advantage, too?
Right. No, exactly right. And I'll give you an example of that. And it's further down the totem pole, obviously. But I'm getting ready to do the Citrus Bowl between Penn State and Kentucky. So it's really the first time I've really looked at Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you ever seen a team from a conference go into its bowl game and is about to play its third consecutive non-conference game?
Yeah, it's so weird. It, like, both Georgia and Alabama had already locked in their division title by, I think it was November 3rd, because they still had these games off in the distance. I think Georgia was the same way. They finished against Georgia Tech and Massachusetts.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, it's so bizarre that, you know, these games that are supposed to decide who goes to the conference championships, which are supposed to be the most important games, like, aren't at the end of the year. I don't get it.
I don't either. Now, Kerry, when you look at the playoff itself, it's going to be Notre Dame, Clemson, Alabama, Oklahoma. Give me something that intrigues you about each game.
Well, certainly the Alabama-Oklahoma game, just no matter what happens on Saturday with the Heisman ceremony, we're going to have it play out in that game between Tua and Kyler Murray. I'm really excited to see that. You know, we've spent most of the past month having that debate, and it always comes back to, well, Kyler hasn't played elite defenses or whatever, and now he will. And Tua's going to be really tested as well to keep up with an elite quarterback for the first time. So I'm really excited to watch them go head-to-head. And then, really, I think Notre Dame has the nobody believes in us factor. There's always one of the four teams that has it, but, you know, they're undefeated. They went 12-0, played a pretty tough schedule, better than people seem to give them credit for. And heading into this past weekend, you know, I saw a lot of theories popping up that, oh, we should put Oklahoma and Georgia in and kick out Notre Dame. They're not good enough. Like, what in the world? Like, that was a really good team. They deserve to be here, and they're still like 12-point underdogs, I think, against Clemson. I'll be interested to see how much fire they're playing with in that game because of that disrespect.
They also have an outstanding defense. Notre Dame, defense travels. Defense travels.
Yeah, they have a very good secondary. I think they've only given up 7 passing touchdowns all season. I think that'll be a really fun game. Travis Etienne against that defense will be a really good one.
And when it comes to the Georgia-Oklahoma debate, I always have a simple theory. You should never lose and get to the playoff.
All right? I don't have a problem with that. I'm kind of the same way in the college basketball. I've been doing bracketology for like a decade. People always want to argue where those mid-majors who falter at the end of the season in their conference tournaments, like, they deserve to get in. Like, well, you just lost. Like, you had your chance.
Right.
So I kind of see that argument against Georgia for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you had your shot. Although I'll say this, there is one thing that every at-large team has in common in the NCAA tournament. They all lost their last game. You know, people are really like, think, oh, yeah, that's right. That's how you got to be an at-large.
Exactly. Yeah, all 36 of them, whatever it is these days.
Right. No, all 36 of them these days. Very quickly, one final question for you. College football TV ratings have been really, really good this year. Ohio State, Michigan, highest rated regular season game ever on Fox. The SEC championship game, great ratings. I know a lot of corporate partner people who follow this closely. I think they're going to be the driving force that gets this thing eventually to 8. How do you view the financial part of it and also the fact that there appears that college football is becoming a hot buy?
Yeah, the fact that ratings are so high is going to play into the proposed expansion of the playoff. I mean, you nailed it there. It really has been incredible. Ratings were actually down a little bit last year, but now they're way up this year because it was so much more entertaining wall to wall. I don't know how much the drama of the Urban Meyer mess played into that, but yeah, it is going to help. Knowing that there are so many more eyeballs on the sport than there were just a year or two ago. I'm seeing a lot more of people buying into the notion that college football it's not better than the NFL. There's not more talent than the NFL, but it's more entertaining. I've seen a lot of people go in that direction. I don't know if it has anything to do with people wanting to boycott the NFL for whatever reason, but there's more attention in college football, and hopefully they don't squander that. We'll see where it goes from here, but certainly the live TV rights with all the cord cutting and streaming and all that stuff, it's really impressive to see it still thriving in spite of all that.
I think the NFL just feels corporate to some people, and I think college football, even though you and I both know it's a business, still feels more collegiate to people.
Yeah, they have the amateur name connected to it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I used to really be in the NFL more until 5-6 years ago, and finally made the switch over fully to college. And I'm not looking back. I think it is just so much more fun. I mean, when I watch an entire 12 hours worth of football on Saturday, and then it's there on Sunday, I'm just like, this is boring.
Yeah.
Just give me more college games. That's where the fun's at.
Yeah, I'm with you. Kerry, absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today, and I hope we get to talk again very shortly.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me.
Kerry Miller joining us from Bleacher Report. Great to have him on the show today. The college football writer Mark Wogenrich is going to join us in the next half hour from the Allentown Morning Call. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Yes, I am in the Mark Lawrence Power Chair today. And I just received a note, and he said something, and the note says, I mean, it's not even signed. I want my chair back. What? It's not even signed. It wasn't from McGranahan, I can tell you that.
Like, what are you doing in there? Who let you in?
Well, for one thing,
they turned the microphone off at 10.
Sammy wasn't out there when I came in, so I just walked right in.
Oh, she's on break. Yeah.
We'll come back with more in a moment. It's party time tonight. It's going to be fun to go out, and you and I have a good time tonight with Buhner and Catrillo and the entire gang. Mark's going to be there. I have a lot of fun there. Mm-hmm. See a lot of the great people that are associated with us on an everyday basis. It'll be great to have fun with them. And they'll have fun with us because we won't be pressuring them to do anything. All right, we'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, great to have you with us on the show. Mark Wogenrich, Allentown Morning Call, in the final half hour of the show today. It's been a relatively slow day sports-wise, and although I'll say this, the Phillies are about to make, one way or the other, they're going to make some news next week, I would think. One way of either not signing somebody or signing somebody. We know they have the funds to do it. The question will be whether or not they do try to pull the trigger to sign either Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, or whether they pull back and say no. But they're going to be a primary player one way or the other. Machado's not going to go back to the Dodgers. He's pretty much made that clear.
Well, when you got Patrick Corbin signing 6 years, $140 million with the Nationals yesterday, you know if that's now going to start to trigger a domino effect as the hot stove starts to get cooking.
Well, I think it does. It also triggers the Yankees because the Yankees wanted Corbin. So now what do the Yankees do?
The Phillies took a look at him, too.
When the Yankees can't sign you, that changes a lot of things.
I'll ask your brother about that on Friday.
Yeah. Excuse me. The, Robinson Cano being dealt, the Corbin thing. I'm telling you, the Gene Segura trade is an absolute winner for the Phillies. Offensively superior to Crawford. I mean, not even the same realm. I don't even know if Crawford could hit 250 in Double A right now. But Segura is superior offensively, and it gets Reese Hoskins out of the outfield and back to his natural spot.
Hi, this is JP from Chimock.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Boy, did Jason Stark write a fascinating article in The Athletic about shifts. We'll get to that the final segment of the show. Very pleased, though, to bring in good friend, outstanding writer, Mark Wogenrich, Allentown Morning Call. Wogo, welcome. It's great to have you back with us on the show.
Appreciate it, Steve.
Let's start with this. Just any quick updates on Matt Millen, because I know you've done a great job of at least keeping track, keeping in touch. I know I talked with Kevin Kugler a little bit last night.
I haven't talked to him in a little bit. Just texting some of the guys who know him. He's doing spirit-wise, doing really well. I haven't seen it yet. Like, I haven't listened to the podcast. I know he spoke with Peter King of NBC Sports, and they did a podcast together. I was kind of hoping to maybe go up. I talked to him a while ago about going up and visiting him in the hospital. I know that... he had mentioned a while back that like the nurses were bringing him dinner and stuff like that in the hospital, so he's not eating hospital food. But as patiently as you can wait for a heart transplant, that's what he's doing right now. His perspective on that is just that if I get one, that'd be great, and I know that's his hope. But as he says, if he doesn't, he's lived a great life, as he put it to me a while back. So, like I said, as patient as you can be while waiting for a heart transplant, that's where he is.
Yeah, I believe he also has told them that if it's a younger person's heart, he wants a younger person to have it. Yeah, so I mean,
right, he has mentioned stuff like that. He's almost taking himself out of certain situations. I know he does feel compelled that he doesn't want to. He doesn't want his illness to affect somebody else's, too.
Yeah.
Which is really a Matt thing. So.
Yeah, no, but that's Matt. That's the way he's always been.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
Always been,
yeah.
He's always been like that. Okay, a reaction to Penn State, Kentucky, and the Citrus Bowl.
The more I looked at it, the more I liked it. I was one of those guys who... And the viability of it, I know. But I was one of those guys who said, if the Citrus Bowl can make Penn State, Mississippi State, at least discuss the option. When you put together a bowl and get a new title sponsor that you announce, that's the kind of game that would draw. I think, draw some pregame national attention. I know that, you know, if the coaches say that they're a little reluctant to get into kind of a rematch of staffs, that sort of thing, I understand. But I was, you know, I thought the bowl might have at least considered it. But that being said, this is two top 15 teams playing on New Year's Day. This is kind of what the bowl system was meant to do. What I like about Kentucky is that this is, it seems like a team on its way up. In a way, this, you know, under Mark Stoops, they've gradually rebuilt from those years that they had. I went back and looked at, you know, when James Franklin was at Vanderbilt, he beat them three times by like a combined score. It was like 85 points, the total margin of victory. I mean, it was astonishing. So to come back and have a chance to win 10 games, I think for the first time in about 40 years. I heard you when I came in talking about Josh Allen. I hope he plays. I thought, you know, I think it'd be great to see a player like that. I do kind of like the matchup. I think it, you know, there's some benefits for Penn State. That seems to be in some ways a one-dimensional offense that Penn State maybe could be able to do something with, but really good defense. So I ultimately, I think I do like that matchup.
Yeah, it's interesting because the designated crossover game, for example, Alabama's designated crossover game is Tennessee. The designated crossover game for Kentucky is Mississippi State, and they beat Mississippi State, actually.
They did, right.
And that's
it was early in the year, right? But they beat them pretty good. I think it was 28-7, yeah. Wasn't it?
And thus, to me, that gives them the leg up as to going to the higher
right.
bowl as opposed to something else.
So. Yeah, there was no question that they should have been. The pick at 9-3, having beat ranked higher, having beaten Mississippi State. No, absolutely no question that they should have been the pick. I was just thinking, a bowl that has a new title sponsor, maybe the,
yes.
you know, Penn State versus Mississippi State
right.
is an option that they get it some national pregame attention. I don't know how much it would have affected things like ratings on game day or attendance or anything like that. But if you're trying to, you know, trying to get some notice of your game beforehand, that might have done it.
They probably would have, especially considering you're this is one of the few bowl games that is in direct competition with other bowl games, because all these
right.
bowl games have their own time slots. That's why it goes out mm-hmm. over a two-week period like it does, because they all get their own time slot until you get to January
yeah.
1, and then you got three of them going head-to-head with the Fiesta
yeah,
Bowl, SU-UCF, you got the Outback Bowl, and you got the Citrus Bowl. So I agree with what you're saying in terms of trying to get a leg up on somebody else. It's the one, mm-hmm. it's the one time you have bowl competition.
And they also, I think, they have a little bit of autonomy in selection that maybe others don't have, because it seems like some of the conferences now pool their bowls together and establish matchups in that way, where you have two or three bowls or four bowls in the pool where you rotate teams. It looked to me like in the selection process of Citrus, and, you know, obviously we'll work with bowls and conferences and teams, but they could have made a selection. They could have done it had they been, or at least they could have proposed it. I'm not saying that they could have done it, but they could have proposed it in the sense of putting that game together. But just on merit, this is the game that should have happened.
What are you looking for, at least initially, in this game, Mark? Is it a conclusion to the 18 season to get 10 wins, or are you looking more at it as a foundation to get 19 going?
In a way, I would almost think a little bit. I'm sure the coaches are looking at it more as the latter. But I think that 10-win, I think that threshold is important to be able to say that. And I think James Franklin is making a point, I think justifiably so, that this is the first time you could put together three consecutive 10-win seasons in the Big Ten era, the first time they would be able to do three, you know, do that since the 80s. Now, granted, that's, you know, you played fewer games then, so if you want to compare winning percentages, that would be different. But that's a mark of consistency that he can then use in recruiting and can use with boosters and with fans and things like that to say, look, if we're not, you know, granted this season we were we fell out of contention for the Big Ten title and for the for the college football playoff, but if we're winning 10 games year after year after year, that obviously gives us a better chance to be in contention. In future seasons, then as far as the future, there's so many guys, especially on defense. There's so many, it seems like so many players who really have an opportunity to be great in the future. And I see that I'm that would be the biggest thing to me. I would look at that defense as if they could put together a real like cornerstone performance and hold Kentucky's offense to, you know, not a lot of yards or points or things like that. That would be the big threshold for me. I'm looking at that. I think offensively they're just going to be so different next year without Trace McSorley that personality-wise, maybe not offensively, but personality-wise, I think they're going to be different. That transition is going to take a little more time, in my view.
And I completely agree with the 10-win threshold being really important. I think that is a really important mark to have. When you're, you know, James talked earlier about great to elite. Well, when you're, if you can string together years where you're a double-digit winner, that shows you you're right in the neighborhood where you need to be going forward.
Yeah, that's close to great. You know, 10-win season, stuff to do. You don't get a lot of teams. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's just not that many. It's, what, six teams, I think. Penn State is one of six teams that's ranked in the top, what, 15 of the final CFP poll for the last, you know, 3 years. That, you know, in order to get to elite, you don't skip a step. I think it was one of the points he made after I said, you don't go from good to elite, or maybe you have that breakthrough, that breakout season, like the Mississippi schools did a few years ago. But you don't skip a step. You don't go from good to elite. You don't go, you know, you That's need right. to be great for, I think, a couple of, yeah, you need to be good. You need to be good, really good, great for a couple of seasons. And that's what pushes you into, you pick up maybe a couple of really high-end recruits, put together a staff that is really composed and, you know, experienced and smart at what they're doing. And that's how you get to that point.
In fact, here's a good one for you. You know how many 10-win seasons UCLA football's had? Zero. Never had one. Right? So, I mean, I know it's
that's
UCLA.
I would have.
I mean, that's, nobody would have guessed
that. Me,
right.
No, not at all.
That's right. Nobody would have guessed. They would have said maybe they've had five or six, maybe 10.
Yeah, I would have said, okay, five. If you, I was thinking, how many? Is he's probably lowballing me here, so I'm going to say five, but zero now.
Right. Zero? No. Let's face it. I think all of us expected Urban Meyer to step down, and he did. What did you think about him stepping down, the circumstances, and then Ryan Day?
I expected him at some point. I didn't think too much in terms of it until I heard it yesterday. I was actually on my way to New York for the College Football Hall of Fame dinner with Kerry Collins and Trace McSorley, and I saw them. I thought, you know, it does make sense at this time because you're 2 weeks out from signing day, from that early signing period day, and since everything revolves around that, I don't know how you could have strung it till after the bowl game and have those kids sign on December 19th, and then if they didn't know, then that's an issue. So I thought that was smart. That was at least open on their end. I didn't know much about Ryan Day as a candidate for that job full time. I understood him as a candidate, you know, as the interim guy, but that didn't occur to me. I mean, I kind of expect the national search for him to go in house like that and keep that transition, at least smooth from that perspective, and Ryan Day must consider Ryan Day a really sharp mind and a really, you know, even sharper recruiter to be able to keep these guys in place and then continue what Urban Meyer's done. I don't know that there's a lot of schools that are, you know, necessarily miss Urban Meyer, and I say that as the football teams he's fielded. I mean, he was 7-1 against Penn State, if you include the bowl game, the Outback Bowl, back in 2011, and some of those games were just hard. You know, those games were just rough. Yeah. You know, since 2014, they've just had some really high end, you know, just really high end, high spirited games, and obviously, 7-0 against Michigan, they won't miss them either. So,
Right, exactly. You know, they won't miss, they will not miss them at Michigan. 4-8. We've now seen 5 years of this. Are you mm-hmm. still with 4, or do you think 8 is actually more realistic?
I think 8 is more realistic, but then my issue then is with the conference title game. We kind of view the conference title game as a de facto first round. Now, yeah. I don't, you know, at what point would, then what do you do with the conference title games? I could see theoretically eliminating them. In practice, I'm not sure that would go over at first, but I could see eliminating them in favor of going to 8. I would probably go with a regular season champion from the 5 conferences, then maybe 3 at large, but then 3 at large. I don't know how you would include the group of 5. My issue is the more games you add, if you keep the conference title game and then you add 3 in a playoff, coaches are going to start saying, well, we're needing more scholarships. And then maybe they're going to want 5 more scholarships to get the 90, and maybe they'll want 27 or 28 a year. And that would seem to pool more players into the Power 5, because you get, 5 more scholarships probably takes 5 scholarships away from those group of 5 teams. So wow. I can't see necessarily. I can't see going to 16. That just, to me, is just, that's too much football. Like I said, it's too many scholarships. The coaches are going to say they're going to want to add, or you maybe say we're going to exempt freshmen from, or freshmen will be eligible for the playoff and still be able to redshirt, something like that. Because once you start adding these games, attrition would become such an issue, I think, at the college level. So, but I like 8. I'm starting to come around on 8 with home sites, and I still think that would still make the bowls viable, too. I think a bowl season from Christmas to New Year's, that's still a very viable option for the other 60 or so, 70 or so teams that are not in the playoff.
Mark, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate your time very much. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, appreciate it, Steve. Thanks. Have a great holiday.
Mark Wogerich, outstanding, from the Allentown Morning Call. One final segment. We're going to touch briefly on Jason Stark's article in The Athletic today on shifts here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. The topic I've discussed before on the show has been shifts in Major League Baseball. Every sport tries to get more offense into their game. And remember, sports have restrictions to them, for example. In hockey, you can't be offside. In soccer, you can't be offside. Right? In basketball, you have, in the NBA, 8 seconds across the timeline. Oh, and you can't go back. College basketball is 10 and you can't go back. They have a shot clock of 24 in the NBA, 30 in college basketball. And then, of course, in football, 2 people can't move at the same time on offense, for example. And only 5 can go out in the pattern. So there are restrictions in every sport. Baseball defensively, the only restriction there is in baseball defensively is you cannot, except for the catcher, line up in foul territory. You can't do that. If you do, it's a balk. That's why when you've seen in the past, before they gave the old, put up 4 fingers for an intentional walk, which is what they do now, you notice how the catcher always had to stand in the box until the ball was released? If the catcher stood outside of the catcher's box to catch a pitch on an intentional walk, just waited for it, that also is a balk. Couldn't do it until left to hand. So now let's get to shifts. Jason Stark, brilliant work. 8,000 more shifts on balls in play in 2018 than in 2017. 28,000 more shifts this year than 5 years ago. 28,000. There were fewer ground ball hits in 2018. 13,213 than there have been since they expanded to 30 teams in 1998, 1,200 fewer than what we saw in 2015. That's right, 1,200 fewer base hits than in 2015. So they've done some research about full shift average versus partial shift. Against a partial shift from 2016 to 2018, the batting average was 226. In 2018 alone, the batting average against a full shift was .224. Against a partial shift, the batting average was .280. It puts more runners into play, which means more action, and that's why they're hoping. And Rob Manfred's talked about this since the first day he took the job as commissioner of baseball about shifts, because he feels it's been detrimental to offense. Grounders, short liners into full shifts, 16,190 last 3 years. Actual hits, 3,502, 216 batting average. Partial shifts, 267. In 2018, grounders or short liners into full shifts, 6,185. Actual hits in those situations, 1,323, a 214 batting average. Hits if the shift were partial, 1,684, you'd instead have a 272 batting average. So that's why they're taking a look at it. What would it look like? Would you make sure that the infield had to have two on the left and two on the right? And how deep are you allowed to play your infielder? Is the second baseman allowed to play short right field, for example? Most shifted batters, Kyle Seager of the Dodgers, he hit 188. Matt Carpenter, the Cardinals, 161. Freddie Freeman of the Braves at 256. Anthony Rizzo of the Cubs at 225. And Matt Olson, when facing the shift, hit 260. And again, that's line drives, short line drives, and ground balls. Now, it's not a perfect solution, but Jason Stark writes a fascinating article on the pros and cons of killing the shift. Every sport has restrictions with it as to how it plays out. And except for the balk rule about lining up in foul territory, baseball does not. I mean, you can't sit in the stands and wait for the ball. They're just trying to get more action into the game. There are two things I think that really took apart Ryan Howard's career. The Achilles injury obviously was one. I felt shifts was another one. That's why you have launch angle now. Launch angle is so important. Why? Because they're now trying to hit over the shift. Talk to you tomorrow.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.